aware of this syndrome that Paul is presenting and the effects of it, the results of it, the consequences of a syndrome. To do this, we have to do some exposition of verses 18 and 19 and 20, and then we'll have a little break from exposition. And what I want to do in these verses is point out three of the key words. The first one is the verb, which we spoke of a little bit last week, and the second one is this word, ungodliness, and the third one is unrighteousness. So in 1:18, we're going to highlight those words. Now I have them on a larger projectile here, which I'm going to put up. It's just the quote of the verse, same as the one that you have. And if you want to take some notes, that's fine. We said we're going to talk about these three verbs, or excuse me, these three words, is revealed, ungodliness, and unrighteousness. And the verse reads this way, "For the wrath of God is revealed from heaven against all ungodliness and unrighteousness of men who hold the truth in unrighteousness." Now this first word that we're dealing with is the verb. It's a present tense, a passive voice, indicative mode. And I don't know why there is no translation that translates this. At least I haven't seen the translation. Excuse me. I looked at New American, and I don't believe it translated passive. Did it? What's New American say in 1:18? Anybody? See, is revealed. Same as the King James. The same verb is used in verse 17, "For therein is the righteousness of God revealed." And it's really, in both of those verses, it's present tense, passive voice, so it should be translated, "The wrath of God," and here comes our verb now, "is being revealed." Does the NIV say that? Well, very good. I need to write that, remind myself of it by writing it in a note. Now, what has Paul said? This is the fourth reason for Paul's readiness to preach the gospel in Rome. Remember? And this is transitional. This is a verse that ensures that judgment is ahead. And the interpreter is responsible to try to determine where is that judgment. Is it present or is it future? And I think this is an assurance of present and future judgment. That is, Paul's ready to preach the gospel because the gospel assures that there's going to be some type of a present judgment and a future judgment of God. And he then puts his verb then in the present tense, which is the word of action, meaning it's going on. And we're going to see before we get through chapter 1 that God gives people up to passions, that are not healthy. He gives them over to a corrupt mind and so on. That's part of the present judgment. But the gospel assures that there's a future judgment too, because Satan, of course, has already been judged according to our Lord Jesus Christ. So this wrath, this anger of God, this hostility of God against these two things is going to manifest itself in time. All right? Now, what are the two things that are highlighted relative to this? Okay, these are two very important words. The word ungodliness, number two, is asabia. It looks like this in English. A-S-E-I-B-E-I-A, asabia. Now, asabia is a negating, the article negates sabia, and sabia is the concept of reverence or worship. It even goes so far as worship. So when you negate that with this little particle, you have no reverence or no worship. And of course, this is no reverence, no worship by men of God. It's a mental attitude of human beings relative to God. If you went to seminary, you would study the doctrine of sabaya, what it is to worship God, what it means to worship God. Well, here you have the negating concept of sabaya, asabaya. The second word that is used is the word Adikaya, that's unrighteousness. So this is number three. Adikaya. All right, dikaya means just, or what is right. And you negate it, and you have not just, or not right. Now what that relates to is the horizontal relationship of human beings on the horizontal plane. In other words, sabaya, which relates to respect for God, drives ethics or morality. This is very, very important, both in the culture war that Paul faced and in the culture war that we face. In other words, this respect for God, which goes this way, without that, you'll have very little respect for mankind, man to man, or man to mankind. The vertical effect of a relationship with God. Have no respect for an absolute deity, and you'll have little respect for mankind. So from a biblical perspective, sabaya drives justice, proper justice. Proper respect for God should result in proper justice or ethics or morality among men. And so what Paul is saying is that there's going to be a manifestation of wrath of God because of these two things that relate to mankind. See, it is the ungodliness of men, or the asabaya of men, and the injustice of men that upset God. And these people hold down or suppress the truth in unrighteousness, in their mentality. Okay? Now, with that in mind, he gives some basis or some reason for his statement in the first part of the verse. That is, that the wrath of God is going to be revealed against these. Excuse me, I should have another overlay here, and I don't see it. It's the one I have for you. What do I do with it? Oh, there it is. Okay. So your overlay looks like this, didn't you? And we had the 1, 2, 3 here. See, now he gives a cause for that. That is, here is God's righteous cause in this issue. Because that which may be known of God, that is, that which may be known that has God as the subject, is manifest in them. Okay, so what this then refers to is the fact of God consciousness. It is in them. These who hold down or suppress the truth cannot deny the fact that they have God consciousness. It is in them. Every human being has God consciousness. Okay? Somewhere in your life you come at a certain age to a fact that there is a God. Now, the issue is, and there's no higher thought that we're capable of than the thought of God. He is the infinite person of the universe. The problem is, does our thought of God correspond to the true being of God, to what the essence of God is really like? This is the problem of mankind. So what God does to make sure that we have the right idea, he gives us his revelation. He gives us his word. Well, this speaks then of a God consciousness. Now, if that is the case, then you have, and he's going to emphasize this, a creator. This becomes the subject of these verses, a creator-creature distinction. This is what he's going to emphasize. He front-loads the gospel with this issue of the absoluteness of God in terms of his creative universe. So verse 18 says, because that which may be known of God is manifest in them. That is, they have a God consciousness. For God has showed it unto them. So we have in them and now unto them. And this is simply empirical evidence of God. And what he's going to highlight of that empirical evidence in verse 20 are two attributes of God. Look. You notice the "it" is supplied by the King James, "for God has showed unto them." God hath manifested unto them. What has he manifested? Two things, verse 20. "For the invisible things of him from the creation of the world." Now that doesn't mean from the moment of creation. It means the evidence of creation. One looks at the created universe, or a universe that operates with such precision, and from that, the invisible things of God can be clearly seen. So let me read it this way. "For the invisible things of him from a created cosmos," translating the world, cosmos, which is the word itself, "are clearly seen." How? "Being understood by the things that are made," that is, by the physical universe in which we live. So there's empirical evidence of God, and they manifest two aspects of his essence. Okay, what's the first one? Even his eternal power. His power. You notice it says eternal, and as he doesn't derive his power from the universe manifests his eternal power. This is his omnipotence. Now, unbelievers give evidence that they innately know that there is an omnipotent God. And when you have a crisis like we had in New York, one of the first things they'll say is, "Why did God let that happen?" That's a backdoor compliment to God by saying he could have stopped it. He could have prevented it. He had the power to do it. You see? "Why did God let my child die?" That's like saying he could have stopped it. He had the power to do it. You see what I'm saying? It's a backdoor, it's an evidence that people know that there is an omnipotent God. So this verse reaffirms that. His eternal power. Now, involved in that also is his omniscience, because the created universe functions so precisely that if we were, a mile closer to the sun, we'd probably all burn up or all have skin cancer. We got enough of it as it is. If the Earth didn't rotate in the precise way that it does around the sun, we would have all kind of ecological problems and so on. So involved, you see, is his omniscience also. The second thing that's manifest is his Godhead. Okay, so the second aspect of the empirical evidence in the created universe is his deity. That is, that he is the absolute and only supreme God. So one can look at the physical universe, and it's evidence enough that God has showed unto him that every person in the world, doesn't matter if you're an ignorant savage in the jungle, you can see by the created universe that there is a God. Okay? All right. Now look what men do. Verse 21. Let me stop for just a minute. Let me stop. Hold it there a minute. So you a savage in the jungle innately knows there's a God because he becomes God conscious. And then he can look around his physical universe and he can say, "Wow, God is awesome that he could create this universe. Look at, I see the same stars at a certain time of the year and so on. Sun always, I see it in the east in the morning, it's in the west at night. So on and so on." But if that's all he knows, that's not enough to get saved. Suppose a tornado comes along and destroys his village or destroys his home. Then what is his thoughts of this omnipotent God of which he's conscious? Well, he might think God's angry with him. Well, then how do I appease this God if he's angry with me? Why did he send the hurricane? Why did he send the flood? Why was our village decimated by a disease? Is God angry with us? So there is a limit to awareness of what deity is like by this minimal amount of information. Here's where the gospel then, you see,
becomes totally necessary because it's in the gospel where we see the absolute love of this infinite God who created the universe. So this is not enough to save somebody, but it's enough that they have, if they respond to that light, God's going to get them more light, you see. Okay, now, look at verses 21 through 23. This becomes very important in the culture war. Verse 20 ends with the statement, so that they are without excuse. Present tense. There's no excuse for any member of the human race anywhere to deny the existence of an absolute deity that has eternal power. All right, now, verse 21 speaks of people who knew God and didn't glorify Him. And what I'm thinking that this verse wants to communicate is what men did in the past and what men do in the present. And consequently, what's going to follow in the judgment section is what God then does, or did, and what He does. What He did in the past and what He'll do in the present. And we're going to have, tonight we're just going to work on what men did and see the results of it. And then we'll save what God did in response to that. And this, for next week, and this then becomes a, what, next week is one of the most critical sections in terms of application of the culture war that we have. Well, let's look what men did. Because that, when they knew God, they glorified Him not as God. That's an active rejection and repression of the existence of an absolute creator God. Is that part of our culture today? Why, it's embedded in the whole culture. You couldn't go to a university in the United States where you would be plagued with this message. We just cannot let God get His foot in the door in our universities. 100 years ago, that was not the case. This is absolutely amazing, the turnaround in this culture war in the United States. So the first thing that men did was they glorified Him not as God. Notice that the Bible starts off with the vertical before it wants to deal with this horizontal stuff. The issue was the vertical. They glorified Him not as God. They glorified Him not as God. They didn't give Him His rightful place in their mentality relative to the creature. They didn't make the right creator-creature distinction. You see? Creator, creature, creature responsible to the creator. Okay? That's just a basic fact. Neither were they thankful. They didn't recognize His benevolence. They did not recognize His benevolence. Okay? Thirdly, the text says, but they became vain in their imaginations. Now that's their reasonings. That's their rationale. Now their mental activity gets involved relative to relationship to a deity they know about, but they're going to diminish Him in His rightful role, and so they become empty. They became empty. That's the word vain. It means futile, meaningless. Notice what it says in their thought processes. In their thought processes, King James says in their reasoning. You see, there's now an active, first there's a repression of who God is and His rightful relationship to the creature, creature's rightful relationship to Him, and then there becomes an empty imagining about this deity. Their thoughts about God did not correspond to the true being of God. You know, there is not a false doctrine or a false ethic that cannot be traced to some imperfect and ignoble thought about deity. Get the thought straight on deity, and this horizontal stuff begins to straighten itself out. This is critical in the culture war. That's why Paul starts, you see, with the gospel, because it's the basis of a worldview. that makes the creator and the creature, brings them into right relationship. So they became empty or vain in their imaginations, and their foolish heart was darkened. That is, their frame of reference now becomes distorted. And professing themselves to be wise, they became fools. Okay? So they became fools, and the word is moros, which we get our word moron from. Now that's not the look. Now we go another step farther in verse 23, and they changed. And the word means exchange. They exchanged the glory of the incorruptible God into an image. Okay. So the fifth thing they did, they exchanged God's glory, which is his essence, which what he is, into an image. Now, an image is an icon. This word icon, E-I-K-O-N, comes from a Greek verb which means to see. So they take. Can you imagine this happening? Now just try to think what's happening. Here's a culture that they say, well, we really don't believe that this deity that we know he exists and he created, we really don't need to depend on him. We can operate independent of him, and we're not going to give our allegiance to him. And we're not grateful for his benevolence. We'll depend on ourselves. And now the artist and the artisans and the cultural people have to get into the act, and they have to design an image of what they think God is like. Involved in this is a whole cultural mix, you see. And so somebody comes up, well, I think he's like this. And an artist now, a sculptor, has to sculpt this image. Can you see the leaders of the community coming? We have to have some concept of what God is like. Would you make this for us? Well, of course, sure. Let's all get our heads together and we'll come up with some idea of what God is like. So they change God's glory, which is uncorruptible, incorruptible, into an image which is corruptible. Okay, now they have, this is the result, a product of men who refused to give God his rightful place in their lives. And now we're down to image worship. So where are they bowing the knee? To the incorruptible God or to the image? Isn't this so? This sounds so stupid. Now they're bowing to an image. I remember once we had a man when I was the president of Western Bible College come from Africa. He was from deep in the jungles of Africa. And he told how that in his culture, when they got to a certain age, they would make each little hut would make an image. And he got to the place where he was a man, and he made this image, and they would worship this image. They would bring sacrifices to the image. They'd bring food to the image. They'd bring flowers to the image. And one day he reasoned, this is his testimony, he says, I reasoned, and I says, why? Since I created the image, and it's my mind that did it, I'm greater than that image, why am I making a sacrifice to this image? It's dumb. I won't do it. He took it out and he burned the image. He was ostracized from his village, but it wasn't too long after that somebody came with the gospel and he got saved. This was his testimony of how he got saved. Well, I have a paper, an overlay. This is not part of your notes. That deals with this question of why men will not bow their knees to their Creator. And it's part and partial of our culture, and I hope that becomes apparent. Those who say yes make a distinction between the Creator and the creature. People groups from the time of Adam have practiced this. There were unbelievers who didn't. But ancient monotheism before the time of Israel, before the calling of Abraham, all the people, the groups descending from Noah. And remember, we all got off the same boat, didn't we? We're all somehow related to Noah. Only four families in the earth after the Noahic flood, and all of us are related to one of those in that family relationship, the whole human race. There were at least two times in the history of the world in which every member of the human race was a believer. And that was Adam and Eve and then the family of Noah. They were monotheists, and they worshiped the one true God. Israel, of course, even before Israel, you see, you had this monotheism. But Israel is an illustration of worshiping the one true God, and of God seeing to it that they knew who he was. Post-Israel, in the church time, monotheist, we all point out the creator-creature distinction. And that distinction says that the right order is God, man, nature. In other words, you do not mix these three. You tend to mix these three and you become a what? A pantheist, which all the Near Eastern Far Eastern religions are all pantheistic. It is only Christianity that makes the absolute distinction between these three aspects of the human race. And what we say in these three is there are everlasting distinctions. That is, there is a creative order. This means creation after or within the Genesis kind. They are created after their kind. Okay? Horses don't produce cows. Cows don't produce pigs. There is a creative order. There is a distinction in the creative order. With that perspective in mind, then there is a personal sovereign deity, which then means absolute, ultimate responsibility. So in this, those that bow to the Creator says we are accountable to the Creator. You see? So there's a sense of responsibility. Well, what about in the pagan concept? Should I bow my knee to the Creator? The answer is no. And in that perspective, always there is a continuity of being. There is not a beginning of a created being. There has to be some continuity of being. Ancient myths, Eastern religions, Western philosophy, modern theology. In the beginning was gas. In other words, you're a product of gas. Maybe four gases in the universe. And so out of this concept, you then have a God that is created after man's kind. In other words, he's a God like men. In other words, you have a process deity. So that the order becomes nature, man, and then plurality of gods. Even nature comes first here. Nature comes last over here. Men in the creative order are higher than the natural order, always. So here you have nature comes first. So that out of this concept of transmutation and evolution comes what is known to be the philosophy of naturalism. In other words, evolutionists identify scientism with naturalism. They claim to have scientific evidence for evolution, which they really don't have.
They can't put the package together. It's impossible. So what they do then is the outgrowth of that is a philosophy, a concept of naturalism, which simply says only natural forces and whether they're material or physical, play a role in the history of life. That's naturalism. That is the deity of the evolutionist. He believes there's a natural process. Now, he can't account for intelligence in, for example, the genome process. Where did the intelligence come that directs that? That directs the genome process in the human being? They try to do that on the basis of chemistry, some natural product, but you can't do it. So from this, then, there comes the concept of naturalism, which is predominant in our society. So you approach these people with the Bible, and they say, oh, no, the Bible couldn't be true. Moses didn't write the Pentateuch. Paul did not write the Pauline epistles. Matthew didn't write Matthew. Q wrote Matthew. So that you had then, out of that, not a self-revealed God, but a process deity, based upon the philosophical assumptions, you see, of men. Now, what then grows out of that? Well, we're all products of impersonal fate and chance. And there's an oscillation between these two, fate and chance. Sometimes it's good, sometimes it's bad. Sometimes you're lucky, sometimes you're not. And the result of this is then you are ultimate victimization. You are a victim of your culture or your society in which you are raised. This is a form of mysticism. And this is extremely popular today. Did you ever read any of Stephen King's writings? Is anybody here read Stephen King? Oh, gee. I have a shot at you. Stephen King is an enormously popular writer. Books sell by the millions. They're demonized. I read the one about the cat cemetery or something. Cat cemetery. And these cats have come back to life, and you walk through the cemetery, you're liable to get... And then I read about one about the car. When the car wrecked, it would restore itself. It was powerful, this car. It's going to run. And crash, it crashes. It's all crash and everything. And all of a sudden, the bumps start coming out of the car. It's mysticism. It's everywhere. It's a demonic control. You see, the pendulum swings in this cultural norm that we live in today. It swings all the way over here to mysticism, and then it swings all the way back over here to some rationalism that tries to explain away deity. Over here, you're just a victim of all these demonic forces and so on in the world. That is a result of this relativistic fate chance concept of life. And it's everywhere in our culture. And consequently, on this side, we say, oh, there's an absolute deity. We're accountable to him. And over here, we say, oh, no, we're victims. We're all victims. Consequently, we don't have any responsibility. No responsibility. And we'll just all lean on the government. And that makes us then politically correct. See? Does that make sense to you? You know where it started? In this passage? It started with rejection of the creator-creature distinction. And Paul front-loads his explanation of the gospel with this issue. It is not just a passing issue. If you like to read, and you want to read something that really challenges the philosophy of naturalism and takes on Stephen Gould and Richard, in England, Hawking, two of the world's most famous evolutionists. Stephen Gould is at Harvard, and Hawking's he just parades all over England. He's at Oxford. These are two world's most famous evolutionists, and they're atheists. And Philip Johnson takes them head on with the concept of, and their concept of the philosophy of naturalism in the book called The Wedge of Truth, which was printed last year, year 2000. Philip Johnson is a lawyer from Berkeley, California, of all places. And he began to write in 1993, and he wrote Darwin on Trial. And he approached Darwinism on the basis of a trial before a judge. And he showed it just absolutely empty. Well, in this latest book, he takes on the philosophy of naturalism, which is a result of accepting the evolutionary theory. And it's absolutely excellent. Why do people refuse to bow their knee to the Creator God? What keeps men from acknowledging a sovereign God of the universe? Humanly speaking, I can only think of one thing, and it's pride. It's arrogance. We know spiritually speaking that Satan blinds the eyes of human beings. But do you see, can you see from this then that we have then worldviews in conflict? Worldviews in conflict. Now just accept that and live with it. Don't let it beat you down. We're in conflict. When I went to work on a degree at the University of Colorado, I didn't expect them to be evangelicals. In fact, I was absolutely amazed at the evangelicals I ran into. My mentor was a Rhodes Scholar from Princeton, and he went to Princeton in about 1918 or something like that, and he criticized the football team. The coach said, "Can you do any better?" He said, "Well, I think I could." He said, "Well, go put a uniform on," and this guy came out and ran rampant. And he was an absolute genius. He spoke 17 languages of Europe, and secretary had to do Czech and German and French when I met him. And he was an ordained Presbyterian who studied at Princeton under the fundamentalists. Took grief from Gratian Machen. And he was my mentor. The head of the philosophy department was also an ordained Presbyterian, and he told his class that he believed in the vicarious substitutionary of Jesus Christ at Calvary for his sins, and that Jesus Christ was resurrected and alive and at the right hand of God the Father. And he told his class that before the class started. He says, "In case this comes out in class, you understand where I'm coming from." You believe this? This was when going to college was a riot, literally. And there was a man in the political science who was a Russian, a Polish guy, and he had been in a prison camp under the Nazis, and another one, and then under the Russians. And he was a believer. He got standing ovations from his class when CU was as liberal. CU was rivaling Berkeley to see if they could be more liberal than Berkeley at the time. One of my teachers was an absolute socialist. If he wasn't a communist, he was that close, and he ended up going to teach at Berkeley. But I was amazed but I didn't expect them to have an evangelical point of view. You see? Because our worldviews are in conflict. I want to read something to you this was printed by the Institute for Creation Research, but it talks about an interview with a geneticist. I want this to hit you. I want you to grab you to see, so you can see the conflict, particularly on the university campus. Well, this is about the DNA code, about the genetic code, and a newspaper reporter from the Ledger in Lynchburg, Virginia, interviewed one of the scientists that was involved in breaking the genetic code. Now, this genetic code thing, that's a marvel. I mean, this is absolutely amazing that they could trace this. It's going to, if time goes on, this will rank as one of the achievements of modern world. It's remarkable. And so this George Kaler of the Ledger in Lynchburg, Virginia, wrote an article called The Biologist that appeared in the Ledger in February 17th, in year 2000.
And he said, I received permission to reproduce, well, John Morris said, I received permission from him to produce parts of this interview. And the interview is between G, that's the interviewer, and J, the molecular biologist and biophysicist. And they used the names because, or they used the initials because he wasn't permitted to put the names down. Okay, here's the J, the molecular biologist. Quote, I'm a bit like an editor trying to find a spelling mistake inside a document larger than four complete sets of the Encyclopedia Britannica. He's talking about one part of the genetic code. Interviewer, do you believe that the information evolved? That this tremendous genetic code process, that you see, there's intelligence there, isn't there? Huh? Is there intelligence? Where'd the intelligence come from to direct this code that, and I'm me now, but at once I was just this little fetus floating around in this sack of water. And before that, I was just a gleam in my father's eye. Where did the genetic, when the sperm and the seed got together, where did the directive intelligence come from to produce me now? So he says, do you believe that that evolved? Genetic scientist. George, nobody I know in my profession believes it evolved. It was engineered by, quote, a genius beyond geniuses. And such information could not have been written any other way. The paper and ink did not write the book. Knowing what we know, it is ridiculous to think otherwise. Interviewer, quote, have you ever stated that in a public lecture or in any public writings? Geneticist, no, I just say it evolved. To be a molecular biologist requires one to hold on to two insanities at the same time. One, it would be insane to believe in evolution when you can see the truth for yourself. Two, it would be insane to say that you don't believe in evolution. Why? Because all government work, all research grants, all papers, all big college lectures, everything would stop. I'd be out of a job. I would be relegated to the outer fringes where I couldn't earn a decent living. Just to say that he was a creationist. One of my friends that I taught with in Southern California in the 70s was doing his PhD at Penn State University under an assumed name. He took his PhD and wrote his dissertation and had it approved under an assumed name, because if he had found out he was a creationist, they would not have given him his PhD. And he worked in the summers in Southern California at the Institute for Creation Research, and I taught at the Christian El Cajon in the university there. It is academic suicide to believe in a God who can create in our culture. There was a man named Emanuel Velikovsky. Emanuel Velikovsky was a Jew, a Russian Jew, a genius. Humanly speaking, he was not a Christian. He was a psychiatrist. He was a historian. And he escaped from Russia, blah, blah, blah. He ended up in, well, I don't know where he ended up. He was in Israel. He ended up in the United States. Well, no, I don't know if he ended up in the United States because he got fired. He's not a believer. He's not a biblicist. I don't even think he believes the Bible. In fact, he's a non-religious Jew. And he taught at Harvard for I don't know how many years. And he wrote two books, Earth in Upheaval, and I don't remember the other one. I have them both in my library somewhere. They're buried in boxes right now. And you know what happened? He advocated catastrophism. He said there probably was an Atlantis, a city of Atlantis, and right about the time of the Exodus out of Egypt, there was some type of a total disruption of the Mediterranean area, and it was a catastrophe, and it buried Atlantis, and Israel went out of Egypt, and so on. And he got fired. Because The high muckety mucks in education couldn't stand the word catastrophism, because Bible people had always believed catastrophism until the 19th century, that there was a catastrophic Noahic flood that covered the earth. And so they couldn't even take the word catastrophe, even a local catastrophism. You know that all geologists now are taught in all the universes that there's local catastrophes? I was flying on an airplane with a guy, and I started talking to him. He said he was a geologist, and I said, where are you going? He told me, I said, what are you going to do? I said, do you believe in catastrophism? He said, why, of course.
And I says, really? I says, I guess they're all local, huh? He says, yeah, they're all local. I says, what if there was one that was universal? Wouldn't that be catastrophic? They all believe this now, that they're all local, you see. Now Emmanuel Velikovsky, now his catastrophism's in. It is academic suicide. I mean, I'm amazed that I made it as far as I did. And when they brought this up, and when I was being questioned by three professors, one asked me if I believed in absolute truth, and I said, absolutely. There's some absolutely true things, and there's some absolutely false things, and then there's some little fuzzy gray in the middle, and that's what we're trying to get straightened out. And I says, I'm really glad you asked the question, because it impinges on philosophy, and really it impinges on who God is. Now, would you like to continue in this thing? This is supposed to be history. I mean, history. They're supposed to be questioning about history. Well, I changed the subject. My mentor changed the subject right away. Listen to this. Remember, the guy just said, no, I can't say it because we'd lose all the grants. Interviewer, I hate to say it, but that sounds like you're being intellectually dishonest. Okay, now here's the geneticist. Quote, the work I do in genetic research is honorable. We will find cures to many of mankind's worst diseases. But in the meantime, we have to live with an elephant in the living room. Interviewer, an elephant in the living room? What elephant? Geneticist, creation design. It's like an elephant in the living room. It moves around. It takes up an enormous amount of space. It loudly trumps us. It bumps into us, knocks things over, eats a ton of hay, and smells like an elephant. But we have to swear that it isn't there. Yeah. That's nice, isn't it? The culture that refuses to acknowledge the creator-creature distinction and hence responsibility and identity can't afford to let God get his foot in the creative door. It's going to make him responsible for that deity. And Paul is laying the groundwork for the gospel in these verses. This is a very, very important. So consequently, what I've tried to illustrate on this page is the disaster that starts with the Acebiah syndrome. Okay, now over here we're going to put Acebiah. Started there, didn't it? Irreverence to deity. Didn't talk about anybody doing sins or terrible things. It just talked about that. Now, watch what happens when you get down to the end of the passage, which is down here, see, next week. Consequences. Inhumanity of man to man. This is adikaya. Adikaya. That doesn't look like that's spelled right to me. I think there's supposed to be another... Well, I'll have to look. I think there should be another A in it. But look, watch what happens. Get down to the end. I'll start with verse 28. And even as they did not like to retain God in their knowledge, God gave them over to a reprobate mind to do those things which were not convenient, being filled with all unrighteousness, fornication, wickedness, covetousness, maliciousness, full of envy, murder, debate. Now you see we're on the horizontal level? Got it? Deceit, malignity, whispers, backbiters, haters of God, despiteful, proud, boasters, inventors of evil things, disobedient to parents, without understanding, covenant breakers, without natural affections, implacable, unmerciful, who knowing the judgment of God, that they which commit such things are worthy of death, not only do the same, but have pleasure in them. Is that, you see that? That's the Acebiah, Adikaya, what I call the Acebiah, Adikaya syndrome. This that looked innocent, oh, I just will show disrespect for God, now ends up in total chaos in terms of human responsibility to one another. So next week, this is what men did. Next week we'll take up now what God did. And this then, we have then one of the clear passages on homosex, you see, and the disastrous consequences of homosex among the human race and the culture, and what effect that has then on the culture. So that's next week. Are there questions we could try to answer in the short few minutes we have left? I appreciate your patience and support and
one quick question.
Yeah.
I mean, this is probably an easy one to answer. So when we see injustice, fornication, wickedness, greed, maliciousness, envy, that's an outpouring of the irresponsibility of
yes.
I'm not acknowledging
yeah.
God. So we could probably get a good
that's,
a good measure of what
yes. Yes, but let me, you recognize that there's something wrong in the culture. Look at just the Muslim thing. It's just the Islam thing without belaboring it. The Islam thing, you now have Muslim terrorist murder who murder 6,000 innocent people, civilians, and then they brag that they did it in the name of God. That has to be something radically wrong with a culture that perceives things that way. Even in the Bible defends a just war. There, you can have just war. It's honorable to be a military person or a policeman. That's an honorable thing. It's not dishonorable. Even in the Christian perspective of war, a just war, you try to end that war as fast as you possibly can in order to save human lives because of your respect for human lives. So you have a terrible... Rap stars glorify violence, abuse of women, violence against women, and Christians buy their CDs. Something's wrong in the culture, you see. Yasser Arafat's a terrorist, and he receives a Nobel Peace Prize. I mean, Boy Scouts are neutered or emasculated, And it's in the name of tolerance that this happens. Let me give you a quote of a guy, okay? There's a guy named Jacques Barzun, B-A-R-Z-U-N. He's a French guy. He's a Frenchman. And he taught at Columbia for 40 years at least. He's 90 years old. And he just finished probably his last book. He's a socio-intellectual historian. He's not a Christian. He just finished a book. Listen to the title of this book. The History of Western Civilization, now listen, from dawn to decadence, 1500 to the present. Yes? Jacques Barzun, not a Christian. The History of Western Culture, from dawn to decadence, 1500 to the present. Here's how he defines a decadent culture. Quote, from page 11, when people accept futility and the absurd as normal, the culture is decadent. And that's exactly where we live today. What's the hope of the culture? What's the hope? Jesus Christ, the gospel. That's what Paul's taking to that decadent culture that Rome represented. Okay? Okay. Okay. The statement is this. This is page 11. Quote, when people accept futility and the absurd as normal, the culture is decadent. Now, don't get the idea that Jacques Barzun is decrying the fact that we're decadent. He obviously takes the evolution. That's just another stage in this progression of things getting better. You have to be kind of intellectually dishonest with yourself to believe that, but... He's not decrying it like I am. And I don't want to try to give that impression, but nevertheless, this is his statement. Isn't it interesting that he starts with the Reformation? He starts with the Reformation. He starts there. Dawn of Western civilization, the Reformation. Oh, that made me happy. All right? So next week, then, we look now. Here's what men did and do. Reject this creator-creature distinction. And now here God gets in the act. Uh-oh. Uh-oh. Look out. Here then, see, is where we then get the concept that the wrath of God is being revealed, is both present and going to be future, you see. Okay. Thanks for your attention.